Why don't, we don't have a quorum yet, but we can start the meeting, and the first item up is the Department of Health budget, and we've got Assistant Commissioner Scott Lights here, or who's going to lead off?
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner Margaret Kelly.
Okay.
We are going to, for the record, I said my name, Margaret Kelly, and it's a pleasure to be here today to present the governor's recs that are in front of your committee for consideration. We are going to walk through them page by page, and feel free to stop me at any point for questions or clarification. And we will begin with it is page 29, our e-health grant. The governor is recommending $29.5 million over 3 years for investments in health information technology to improve patient safety, interconnect clinicians and communities, and strengthen and improve public health in Minnesota. This proposal builds on Governor Pawlenty's 2006 initiative to establish an interoperable electronic health records grants program for rural and medically underserved areas, which the Minnesota legislature funded last year with $1.5 million. Many larger hospitals and clinics have benefited from significant investments in health information technology, yet a widening gap exists between large provider organizations and those in rural and underserved communities. This proposal will make significant strides in closing this gap. And as the private sector invests millions in developing and implementing their own systems, they are growing increasingly frustrated with the public sector's lack of capacity to electronically exchange information. This proposal will help narrow this gap as well. There are three components to this proposal. The first component is matching grants to rural and underserved providers. Eligible providers include community collaboratives, which are rural and underserved healthcare organizations working together to improve the quality and continuity of care in their area. Community clinics are eligible. Community clinics are defined in statute. Community or regional health information exchange organizations, which are established to develop, test, and securely implement a standards-based exchange of health information. And finally, local health departments. Two types of grants will be funded, planning grants which fund the development of initiatives, and implementation grants which support the purchase and implementation of interconnected electronic health records. The second component of this proposal is grants to support the MinFin implementation. The 2004 legislature directed MDH to prepare a plan for the development and implementation of a statewide public health data management system. We refer to this system as MinFin. These grants will update public health information systems so that they adhere to emerging data standards, establish standardized data exchange capabilities with private clinics, hospitals, and laboratories, and create greater interoperability among public health agencies to improve client services and population health assessments. The final component is technical assistance and support. The health department will ensure that grantees are adhering to proven planning models and selecting electronic health records that meet interoperability standards. The health department will work with community and regional health information exchanges to develop and implement technical, privacy, and security standards to protect the confidentiality of patients' information. And finally, we will support and staff statewide efforts to adopt national health data standards and create detailed implementation guides for information exchange. And this proposal is funded over 3 years out of the Healthcare Access Fund.
Questions?
We'll move on, if there are no questions, to the Merck Federal Compliance, which is on page 32. The Merck Grant Program, which stands for Medical Education and Research Costs, provides funding to hospitals and clinics that host the clinical training of physicians, dentists, pharmacists, advanced practice nurses, physician assistants, and chiropractors. Funds for Merck come from a variety of sources. First, a dedicated portion of cigarette tax, a carve-out of medical education funds from capitated Medicaid rates, and federal Medicaid matching funds. Since 1998, the Merck Fund has distributed over $300 million to training sites around the state. The grant program was established to offset the higher costs incurred by teaching facilities. A key tenet of the Merck program is to ensure that funding follows trainees to care delivery sites. This tenet has become increasingly important as the training of medical professionals has moved increasingly from inpatient to outpatient settings. In recent years, the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, has expressed an increasing reluctance to continue providing federal matching funds to Merck unless funds are more closely tied to Medicaid volume at each site. We could make these changes to the Merck distribution, but making the changes in response to CMS requirements by focusing the distribution solely on Medicaid volume would result in a significant shift in funding among the current Merck grant recipients. It would also result in a shift away from the primary goal of Merck to have funds follow students to the site of training. Given the potential loss of federal funds for Merck, this proposal before you would modify the distribution formula to meet CMS requirements while also attempting to maintain funding where training occurs. The current grant program distributes a single pool of funds with a single formula. This proposal would establish three pools of funds. The first pool, $10 million, would be distributed based solely on Medicaid volume at each facility, and federal funds would be sought to match these dollars. A second and smaller pool, $4.4 million, would be distributed based solely on education volume at each facility. No federal funds would be available for this pool. And finally, a third pool, $2 million, would be directed at projects aimed at increasing the rural mental health workforce and incorporating patient safety principles into graduate health professions education. These three pools would distribute $8 million of new healthcare access funds and $8.4 million of existing dedicated cigarette tax revenue on an annual basis.
Commissioner, do we currently spend any healthcare access fund money on Merck?
Mr. Chair, when Merck grants were first initiated, we funded them out of the general fund and the healthcare access fund. When the tobacco settlement came to the state, we shifted the funding to the endowment, the medical education endowment. When we did away with that endowment, we shifted the funding to a dedicated portion of the cigarette tax funding. There is a small amount of healthcare access fund dollars that are appropriated to the University of Minnesota, which are matched, and the federal match is allocated in the Merck distribution, but the healthcare access fund money that generates that match is spent by the university, not by the Merck grant program. So I guess that's a long way of saying at this time.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, these Merck grants then go to an institution to support clinical training of these kinds of medical professionals, or do they go directly to the student? And further, at what point is this healthcare professional in his or her clinical training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the funding goes to the training site and not to the individual. And it's when they are in their clinical training portion of their education.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, where are or what are these sites other than the University of Minnesota? Is it most of our sites that provide medical training?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are sites all across the state. The top big recipients of the grant are the university, Hennepin County Medical Center, Mayo, St. Mary's in Duluth, and Ramsey, the region in Ramsey County.
Mr. Chair. How about Center Care in St. Cloud, or is there anything in the St. Cloud area that would receive these grants for clinical
Mr.
training?
Mr. Chair, and Representative, I'm told there is, that they do receive grants.
Representative Erickson, there's a family practice residency program in St. Cloud that gets money, and the state of Minnesota is very unusual in that if a historically, residents and med students spent all their clinical time in a major hospital. And since the world has changed and most medicine is now delivered in clinics, if a resident or a medical student or nurse practitioner or whoever happens to be getting part of their training in a clinic, the money goes to the clinic for the extra costs that they're associated with. It's very unusual that would happen any place except Minnesota. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, if there are no more questions, we'll move to page 39, which is the healthcare access survey. And this proposal would provide $600,000 in funding from the Healthcare Access Fund every 2 years for survey research to both monitor access to health insurance and the factors influencing changes in access to health insurance in Minnesota. Past versions of this survey conducted in partnership with the University of Minnesota have provided a wealth of detailed information on health insurance coverage and access in Minnesota. In addition, they have enabled the state to identify disparities in health insurance by race, ethnicity, and geographic region, and to understand the factors influencing trends in health insurance coverage in Minnesota. This is information that is not available from any other source. The survey was conducted most recently in 2004, and currently there are no plans for updating it unless state funding is obtained. Past versions of the survey have been funded by either foundation grants or, more recently, grants from the federal government. The federal grant program that funded the 2001 survey and part of the 2004 survey has been discontinued, and we've been advised by our foundation supporters that they will likely not continue funding this proposal into the future as well. Lawmakers are considering a wide range of proposals to reduce uninsurance in Minnesota this year, and funding this biannual survey will enable policymakers to monitor and evaluate the impacts of policy changes aimed at increasing health insurance coverage. This would be funded out of the Health Care Access Fund.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Assistant Commissioner. I just want to say I found this very useful, and if we're moving ahead on improving access to affordable health insurance, this is the way we're going to be able to track whether or not we're successful. As we've talked about in other committees, the need for more outreach for people to be aware of what's available to them if they're uninsured. This is a way to actually figure out where you need to target your resources to reach those individuals. So I've at least found it very useful. I hope we'll consider it seriously.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley, and to the testifier. Are the survey questions public?
I'm going to defer to Scotland.
And Mr. Chair and testifiers, I was just wondering if they're available at the same website where the survey results are found.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Scott Lights with the Health Department. Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the survey questions are indeed public. I don't believe we have them currently posted on the website, simply because most people aren't all that interested in actual research tools, the tools that are used in the field, but rather the results that come from them. But it is public information, can be made available to anyone who does ask. And in fact, the survey methodology that's been developed over the course of the past several years that does the survey work on this survey, in fact, has been sort of replicated in a number of other states and is considered to be a very reliable and state-of-the-art tool.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kelly.
Mr. Chair, we're going to continue with page 41, which is our long-term care and alternative proposal. And before I walk through this proposal, I want to say a few words because the next series of proposals are fee-related, and I wanted to talk about how we handle fees at the Department of Health. The Commissioner of Health is charged with regulating a wide variety of activities, literally from birth to death. And in many cases, it makes sense that the regulated entity fund the cost of our regulatory activities. And the recommendations in the Compliance Monitoring Division are all fee proposals, and I just want to talk about some of the principles and guidelines we follow at the Health Department. First, fee revenue is not dedicated to the department. We deposit all of our fee revenues into the state government special revenue fund. And we receive a corresponding appropriation, a direct appropriation from this fund to support our regulatory work that we do. And this is one way in which the legislature has review of and authority over our level of spending in regulatory programs. Second, fee programs strive to be self-supporting. The Department of Finance policy and state statutes direct us to set fees at a level that does not significantly over or significantly under recover costs. We keep track of revenues and expenditures for each fee program to ensure that they're in balance. The Department of Finance prepares a biannual report on fees statewide. It is called the Departmental Earnings Report, and I believe it was just released last week. Third principle is that fees are reviewed annually. We review fee revenues and expenditures on an annual basis to ensure that we are not over or under recovering. We make adjustments to our spending annually to ensure that our expenditures do not exceed revenues if possible. The Department of Finance policy and state statute direct us to evaluate our fees over a five-year time frame, the current fiscal year, 2 years prior, and 2 years into the future. And because of this, we recommend adjustments to a number of fee programs each biennium. And prior to recommending a change, we consider our statutory responsibility, the appropriate level of spending for the activity, potential efficiencies that we could make to reduce our expenditures, and consumer expectations for services provided by the department. The final point, number four, is that the legislature reviews all fee changes, including new fees. Statute requires that any increase, decrease, or new fee be brought before the legislature for approval. So the following series of proposals are all changes to some of the fee programs that we have. They represent just a small portion of the regulatory activity that we do. The first on page 41 is long-term care and alternatives. There's been a rapid growth in the home care industry in recent years. There are now over 1,200 qualified providers, which is an increase of 55% since 1997. This trend is likely to continue for two reasons. First, baby boomers are reaching ages where some assistance in living may be needed. And second, providing just the service that is needed in an individual's home will be less costly than placement in a nursing facility. This proposal has three components. The first component is an adequate workforce to address background studies. Based on the outcome of a background check, individuals may be disqualified from working in certain direct care positions. They may seek to have that disqualification set aside, and the department needs to keep up with the request, do a thorough review, and set aside those which merit it. So this proposal will add one FTE to this area to eliminate the current backlog and maintain a timely review of requests. The second component is consumer information. How home care providers are classified and what health care services they offer can be complex and confusing to consumers. This proposal will add an FTE to make information on home care providers and their contracted services available on the web in user-friendly formats which can be searched easily. That information is currently not available in an easily accessible form to consumers. The third component is strategic planning. The Commissioner of Health is responsible for assuring home care providers meet specified standards, and the current fee structure does not support existing regulatory strategies in this area. So we're proposing to add an FTE to work with providers, advocates, consumers, and regulators to determine the most appropriate regulatory strategy for this industry and what the corresponding fee structure is. Rather than come forward and put a proposal on the table that nobody would agree to, we'd like to work with all the participants and come up with a strategy that's going to work for everyone and be agreed to by everyone. We don't need to adjust the fees at all to make any of this happen. We just need to increase our appropriation for this activity.
Commissioner, this does not include inspections of nursing homes, I would take it.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. This is not nursing facilities. This is home care providers, so those providers where it's outside of the facility.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Commissioner. I'm wondering in terms of, I like providing more information to consumers. The web isn't always the best tool for many, but particularly seniors, but it's better than nothing for the family members and others. But I'm wondering, have you had discussions with the Department of Human Services, which has gotten federal grants, has been working really hard on establishing a web-based system of information for seniors, and I think it's also helpful to the public that they don't have to go from one state agency to another's website to try and access information. And I think they've kind of done the most work in terms of becoming a reliable source for seniors, advocates, family members. And I'm wondering if you're envisioning a partnership where it would actually be on maybe their website rather than on MDH's, because that's the place that I think most would tend to look.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we work very closely with the Department of Human Services in developing the Nursing Home Report Card, which is a web-based consumer information tool on nursing facilities. And we anticipate using that exact same model in developing the consumer information for this as well. And we have not gone far enough down the road to determine whose website it actually would be located on, but we would work closely with them on developing this.
Commissioner, continue.
The next proposal, our Housing with Services fee adjustment on page 42. Housing with Services is the fastest growing registration category in the Compliance Monitoring Division. There's been more than a 1,200% increase in registered providers over the last 10 years. Last month, there were 1,148 Housing with Services providers, and about 800 have chosen to comply with the assisted living title requirements that were passed last session. The registration for Housing with Services is currently a paper process, and we are only able to post a list of providers by county on our website. There's no way for consumers to compare the services offered by one to the other unless they call each provider and do their own comparisons. Even then, if information is provided to them in different ways or services are grouped differently by providers, it's difficult to compare providers one to the other or to compare the services they offer. So this proposal will allow the department to capture information electronically and to put it in a searchable database on the web, comparable to the proposal we just spoke about. In order to do this, we would need to increase the registration fee from $35 to $155 and appropriate the additional revenues to support this registration process.
Don't see any questions, so you can move on to the next page.
I will continue with page 43, which is mortuary science fee increase. Legislation passed in 1997 directed the Commissioner of Health to license and regulate crematories, but it did not establish a fee to support this activity at that time. Current fee revenues are not adequate to support the regulatory oversight that is required in statute. The state cremation rate has increased from 25% in 1997 to over 40% in 2006. And the number of crematories in the state has increased as well, from 17 in 1997 to 51 today. In addition, our current appropriation is not sufficient to maintain the current level of service we provide beyond just crematory inspections, but to funeral establishments, inspections, and licensure as well. Although we have improved efficiency in the past few years through online renewals, we need to recover our current and future costs. There are now 550 funeral establishments across the state, 51 crematories, and 1,475 licensed individuals. Our staff conduct 375 inspections each year and investigate 50 complaints each year. They also monitor pre-need trust accounts, which total more than $70 million in Minnesota. We are proposing to increase the existing license fees and establish a new crematory license fee similar to the license fee for funeral establishments. We're also proposing to appropriate the additional revenue to support the licensing and inspection process.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question on this is, it's been called to my attention that there may actually be some air pollution quality issues related to crematories, and now that so many are being installed new. You noted the growth here. Would the emissions and whether or not appropriate scrubbers, et cetera, that sort of thing are on them, would that be an issue for your agency and its oversight and regulation, or would that be an issue for the Pollution Control Agency?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Locker, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have a complete answer, but I can tell you that we do inspect the equipment that crematories use to make sure it is meeting expected standards. The Pollution Control Agency sets standards for air pollution, and how we work with them in this area, I would have to get back to you.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. And Ms. Miner, are these annual fees for funeral establishments, crematories, individual mortician licenses, or is there a renewal like every 2 years, 5 years?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, these are annual fees.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could add, what I thought was very interesting is that there are many funeral establishments that have multiple licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And simply for the purposes of advertising, so that they can advertise multiple ways. And so in working with funeral establishments and crematories, we have not seen this level of fee change to be of concern to the industry.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair, about the previous presentation, housing with services fee. The reason we didn't have any questions on this end was we sat in disbelief to see a fee increase from $35 to $155.
Commissioner, you can continue.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is page 44, our occupational therapy fee reduction. There's been a steady increase in the number of occupational therapy licensure applicants without an equivalent increase in regulatory costs. In the 2004 and 2005 biennium, a license fee holiday was approved by the legislature, and we had thought that this one-time correction would bring fee revenues and program expenditures into balance. We're finding that the current fee continues to over-collect. So we are proposing a permanent reduction in licensure fees for occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants. By reducing fees by 20% for each new or renewing licensed applicant, the surplus that we've accumulated will be reduced over time, and the remaining fee level will be able to support the regulatory function of the section.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the Assistant Commissioner, are there other licensed providers that are also being over-collected upon?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we, again, review our fees annually, and this is the one area that we have at this point of time where we have our regulatory costs have remained stable and the number of applicants have grown, and so we simply don't need the revenue that we're collecting. In most other cases, when the number of applicants, you know, the pool of candidates or whatever is growing, we find that our administrative costs increase as well, and so they stay in line. But this is an exception and a pleasure to bring before you.
Nobody is suing occupational therapists.
Commissioner, you can continue.
Mr. Chair, that brings us to page 45, hearing instrument dispensers fee adjustment. Administrative costs in this area and the number of practitioners in the system have varied greatly during the last 5 years. There's legislation passed in 2005 that excluded licensed audiologists from certification for dispensing hearing instruments. This change greatly reduced the number of persons paying certification fees from over 400 to less than 175. At the time, no changes were made to the fee levels because we thought that we were collecting sufficient revenue to support our work. But more importantly, we weren't able at the time to determine the fiscal impact. We didn't know how many people would be excluded from the pool of certified applicants. Now we know that since this change, revenues have declined by over 50%. Having to certify fewer people did reduce administrative costs. However, other costs have remained significant and have actually exceeded the revenue generated by the fee amounts paid by the smaller pool of practitioners. We have complex investigations of hearing aid consumer complaints, and these continue to be both a cost driver and a workload driver. We anticipate complaints will continue to increase as our population ages. There's an increasing number of appeals of failing examination scores, which also increases our cost. And the cost of administering the hearing instrument dispenser exam continues to increase, including the cost to purchase the written exam. We're proposing to increase certification and exam fees and add a temporary surcharge for the next 4 years only to ensure that we generate adequate revenue to cover the regulatory costs of the program. This is an area in which we are making sizable increases in the fees that we feel are necessary because the number of applicants and the number of people that we are registering has actually significantly been reduced. Yet the number of complaints we are getting is disproportionate to this group of practitioners, and that's really what's driving our costs here, is our investigation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you just tell us, in this on this one, and going back to the previous one as well with the occupational therapists, how much is the fee for these people?
If we go back to occupational therapists, the fee will go from $180, that's a biennial fee, $180 down to $145 for occupational therapists. And for OT assistants, the biennial fee will go from $100 down to $80. So that's a 20% reduction. The hearing dispenser fees are a different story, and the fee increases are quite sizable to maintain our regulatory responsibilities in this area. The individual certification fee will increase from $350 to $1,000. The temporary annual surcharge, which will last 4 years, will be $200 per person. The exam fee will increase from $250 to $700 per exam. And if I could put that into context for you, a hearing aid will cost a consumer at retail somewhere between $1,000 to $4,000 per hearing aid. And the range of hearing aid costs to the dispenser from the manufacturer ranges from $200 to $1,500. So the markup averages from 500% to 2,000%. And if we were to average the cost of a $1,000 fee of certifying an individual practitioner upon the sales that they make of hearing aids, and if we were to assume that they pass on the full cost of their certification to the consumer, it would increase the cost of a hearing aid to a consumer on average $3 when they're already paying $1,000 to $4,000 for a hearing aid.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is a little bit out of your realm of expertise, but why is it such a huge markup?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't answer that question because I don't know.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, what are the qualifications, and are there different levels of training or different levels of providers that exist that can dispense periods?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that there are different levels between audiologists can dispense a hearing aid without being certified, but hearing aid dispensers need to be certified. And then there's another level of trainees. And we do have a policy proposal that will, I don't know if it will come before this committee, which proposes to allow those in training to be supervised by an audiologist, which would then expand in the future the potential pool of practitioners who would be subject to this fee and may spread the cost across a greater number of people.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask if you could provide us, I've been trying to write down as you tell us the different categories and the different fees, but we're covering a few of them here, and I just wonder if you could give it to us in writing at some point, just a list of, you know, so that we get a better overall idea of what the individuals involved are going to be either gaining or losing here.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that. I had hoped to have that for you today. Mm-hmm.
Continue.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the governor's recommendations for the health department in your area.
Any questions for the commissioner? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity. We look forward to helping you out as you put your bill together.
Next, we're going to the Human Services Department, and Brian Osberg will continue his presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for the Department of Human Services, and I'm going to pick up on page 127 of your book. And before I do that, I want to make a correction from what was said yesterday. Mr. Chair, you asked specifically about how we treat retirement instruments, 401ks. In terms of determining assets and measuring assets for people eligible for our programs, we actually have a bifurcated approach. We have a situation whereby for certain individuals, families and children and people in Minnesota care, we do not include 401ks and other retirement instruments in the calculation of assets. For everyone else, we do. There's a few exceptions. Medical assistance, people in medical assistance who employ persons with disabilities, we do not include assets that are retirement instruments either. So there is a different. In fact, I think we provide that information to your staff, so you can see from that email exactly how we do differentiate in terms of how we treat retirement instruments.
I received that, Commissioner, and it was informative, except that. What is medical assistance plan A and plan B on that list? The plan B is the one where you do count the...
Medical assistance is called method A. And so all it means is that those families and children in medical assistance are subject to method A, and other people in medical assistance, elderly and disabled, are subject to method B, which does not include retirement instruments in terms of excluding the assets.
Thank you.
On page 127.
Just for the members, that means that if somebody goes on Minnesota Care, they don't lose their pension.
Right. Mr. Chairman, you're correct. That not only does it include 401ks and IRAs, but also pension programs. That's true. On page 127, again, there's an error on page 128 in terms of the... that should be $12, not $20, in terms of the monthly maximum for pharmacy copayment, out-of-pocket copayment. It was $20 before, and now it's $12. In page 131, you can see how much money we spend in terms of basic health care services for elderly and disabled. And again, this does not include long-term care services or home and community-based services. This is just for what we call basic health services, hospitalization, physician, dental, pharmacy, and such. And even though we have maybe a third of our medical assistance clients are elderly and disabled, majority of our cost is in this category, which is not a surprise. And Mr. Chair, members, page 132 is our next proposed budget change. And this proposal will continue our provider pay for performance program that we've had in place for the past year for clients on our programs. We have diabetes, and to extend this program to people with cardiac disease. Obviously, cardiovascular disease and diabetes are chronic diseases that have substantial impact on the health of our clients and the cost of our programs. And by providing optimal care, what we mean by optimal care here is good results and results, not just what care is provided, but meaning good results. And for diabetes, for example, optimal care is defined as hemoglobin A1C levels, cholesterol level, blood pressure level, and whether or not the person smokes. And there's a fifth one that's escaping me right now, but that's how optimal care for diabetes is defined. And there is a general acceptance as to how best to define that optimal care in the community. This relates to both our MAGE care clients and our fee-for-service clients as well. We're providing this kind of incentive to providers. And as you heard last week when we presented our Healthy Connections proposal, we're introducing a payment for performance for our clients as well, for those who enroll in our Minnesota Care program. So we're trying to suggest that payment for performance to clients and providers, we think, will add certainly to better health care results over time. Now, what we've done here is we have two methods of paying for this. One is that we've combined our efforts with the large employers in this community in a program called Bridges to Excellence, whereby we're providing incentive payments to providers if those certain clinics exceed a target in terms of optimal care being provided. And target for 2007 is going to be 20%. Well, you're saying, well, that seems pretty low, and it is. Well, actually, the results, when we first measured this, the results were only 6% of people with diabetes in this state received optimal care. And for our clients, it's only 5%. So we have a long ways to go. We have a long ways to go in terms of getting to that optimal target. The second method we have is for our fee-for-service clients, where we pay providers directly for every one of our clients who exceeds or who meets that optimal care level. So we're going to do both methods and see how they work going forward.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. I'm a little bit confused. Maybe I'm just not tracking you completely here, but you're talking about optional care, and then you were talking about outcomes before. And you're talking, are we talking about two different programs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, talking about optimal care. I'm sorry. Optimal care meaning the best,
right.
Optimum or...
Right, I'm sorry. I meant that.
Yeah.
Okay, optimal, not optional. But still. Right. I understood that, but still, are we talking about outcomes? You're talking before about focusing on outcomes. Now you're talking about focusing on care. What am I not getting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we're talking about outcomes here in terms of desired outcomes for this person who's a diabetic or a person who has a cardiovascular disease. So we're talking about results. And such as I said, in terms of blood pressure level or cholesterol level, or their sugar levels, you know, hemoglobin A1C levels and things of that sort. We believe that's where we need to get to, is to reward providers for not only doing the right thing in terms of following maybe appropriate guidelines, but getting the right results at the end of the day. And as I said, there's an effort working with the private sector in accomplishing that. We have a spectrum for everything from developing clinical guidelines that are evidence-based to doing payment for performance around something like registered excellence. And in between that is doing quality improvement and measuring performance and publicly reporting that performance. Those are the five steps in this process. And that's what acute care is all about. When you hear about acute care, which was announced last summer by the governor, it's working with the private community, medical community and purchasing community, to develop a set of standards by which we can say, yes, we're making progress and getting better health results in this community. And that's the collective work that we're very excited about and we continue to build on. And payment for performance is part of that. There's other efforts. I serve on the board of Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, for example, which does clinical guidelines, but also do quality improvement with medical groups. We think that the only way we're going to make progress, frankly, in getting more affordable and effective health care provided to people in Minnesota is to work hand-in-hand with the private community. We, as a government purchaser, we're not even big enough to affect the market. What we need to do is work hand in hand with the market to make that kind of change. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's why you hear about acute care and you hear about trying to get administrative uniformity or simplification. All those efforts are part of trying to reform the healthcare system by the way we buy healthcare, not necessarily by the way we regulate healthcare. And that's a different role for government, a role we think is very appropriate.
Commissioner, could you give us an idea of what the percentage... we're talking about a change page here, which is $845,000, or $791,000, I guess. What's the percentage extra that somebody's going to get if he meets your quality criteria?
Mr. Chairman, the provider would get $250, maybe twice a year, up to twice a year, if they meet, if our client meets that optimal care definition.
That'd be per enrollee.
Per enrollee.
Right.
That's right.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you know, talking about the different role of government and how to do things, what I've seen is there's a model called citizen healthcare, where citizens with these very issues, diabetes and heart problems, meet in groups, and that the research shows that the patients actually do better with a group support model, and they have significant improvements by just talking to each other and being able to talk in a group about what issues are going on. Have you considered any incentives for that type of care? It's more about, doctors up here, patients down here, moving to more of an equal level and talking on more of a peer level about what's happening with folks, and then involving them in that kind of a relationship.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik. Well, in fact, our next proposal addresses that in part, and that's providing some incentives for primary care providers to work with others to collectively address healthcare needs of our clients. I think over time we need to look at whether or not, you know, for group sessions or paying for phone consultations and things of that sort, maybe something worth examining. But so we're very interested in trying to look at how we change our reimbursement model to do the right thing, to reward the right performance by providers. And I know your committee has been looking at that issue, because by and large our reimbursement system does not really incent the right results sometimes, and that's what I think we need to concentrate on. And we're willing to certainly work with you on looking at those options.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up is Bill Doherty at the University of Minnesota has done a lot of work on this and has outstanding results. So I hope I can show you where to access that research, but I hope you'll take a look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick, this relates back to St. Mary's testimony last week, and the trouble is if you're a 16-year-old kid that's found to have diabetes, it doesn't take a genius of a physician to figure out what the problem is and what the amount of insulin that kid ought to get. The real problem is that kid has to change his life, the family has to change their life, and how do you make sure that that's done? And by and large, our reimbursement system does not pay for the kind of things you're talking about. Representative Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just real quick on that, that's a huge piece. Lifestyle changes for most of us are difficult, but then when you add in traditions and cultures and things that you've been taught over the years, whether it's fried foods or being heavy on the starches, it's easy sometimes for a provider to say, let's just take out the potato. But it's harder to implement if that's really all that you've known. And so I'm going back to Representative Slawick's point around having group therapies, whether it's within your own community, to being shown a different way to do things is something that, unfortunately, is what we're going to have to do if we really want to see some lifestyle changes in many families to get a handle on, especially the juvenile diabetes rate, because folks need help in changing their lifestyle. It's easier to speak and teach it. It's different to walk it every single day.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the Commissioner, I know that this proposal just deals with those with diabetes and specific cardiac issues. What are those specific cardiac diseases that's going to be covered under this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hush, I believe there would be included CHF, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, and those two, 50, and stroke.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Osberg, first just a clarification. When you work through the managed care entities, is there a provision in the contract that the funds flow to the specific clinics and clinicians that are making that achievement? I understand the direct payment under fee-for-service.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, that's true. It would be a pass-through to the health plan, to the provider directly.
And
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Osberg, the conditions you've discussed are ones that are primarily we found in the adult population, and particularly now as you evolve into diabetes, it has to do with things like food support, and it's a lot, you know, some neighborhoods and communities have fitness and wellness centers nearby, and some don't have any of that kind of investment, and I hope it'll be interesting. I hope that as you pursue the research, you look at how that works across populations. But on page 124 is some information on the well child visits for PMAC clients. And while it has improved dramatically from 27% of children under eight, in the first 15 months of life actually achieving six or more visits, which is the recommended, it's gotten up to 47%, but that's still less than half of our PMAP enrollees, youngest children, getting that the kind of medical attention they need for that healthy start. And I'd like to know a little more about why we aren't looking at these sorts of approaches, particularly for our child population, because I think that's key. I mean, to avoiding diabetes in later life, I've seen a lot of research that says you can predict in toddlers environmental issues within that family, diet, et cetera, that could be life-saving if implemented at that early age, and yet I don't see the same level of performance in and attention to the children.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, it's a good point. In fact, we do intend to expand this to include depression and asthma as well. I think our next steps after diabetes and cardiovascular disease is those two areas. Of course, part of our acute care initiative is really focusing on preventive care for children. That is our biggest focus at this point, and we'll continue to have that. That is certainly part of our arrangements we have with managed care organizations in our what we call child and teen checkup program, and we'll continue that emphasis, but we also want to add asthma certainly as a critical component of this payment for performance arrangement over time.
Okay, Commissioner, you can continue.
Yes. And on page 133, you see the costs associated with this proposal, and we do get offsetting savings. We don't, someday we'll have net savings in this area, but right now we do have offsetting savings that are included in this proposal. On page 134, the next proposal is our physician-directed care, coordinated care program. And this proposal will provide physician-directed care coordination to manage complex health services for clients with chronic illness. Those clients in our fee-for-service program are those people with diabetes who have complex health care needs. And they can best be served with a program like this, whereby the care coordinator, again, through a physician office, can help navigate the client's ability to get through the health care system while avoiding costly inpatient and emergency costs. Now, this is really a key component of the medical home idea, and you've heard more about that perhaps recently, and that is that it's important for a lot of our clients to have a medical home whereby they know that they can have assistance in seeking necessary care. And even though we're real concerned about the state of primary care, not only in this in Minnesota, but also across the country. Now, this is not going to solve that issue, but we believe we need to provide incentives for primary care providers to coordinate care provided for our clients, especially those with complex needs. And that's what this proposal would do. Even though it's going to apply just to our fee-for-service clients now, this could be a model for our managed care arrangements, especially as they develop options to serve people with disabilities. Now, this is how it would work. We would reimburse healthcare clinics that provide a defined set of activities, around $50 per person per month is what we're looking at. And this, then in return, what would happen is that care coordination among primary care doctors and specialists would be provided. There would be an integration of medical services with community support resources, including social services. And very importantly, patients and families would be involved in developing their care plan. Now, this would complement what we already put in place, or about to put in place, in terms of an intensive care coordination model that was approved by the legislature last biennium. And that is, for our high cost, most costly cases, what we're going to do is contract with a care coordination organization, care management organization, that will provide that kind of activity. This will also build on our other medical and pharmacy management activities that we have. We have a program in place, for example, whereby we pay pharmacists a fee beyond their dispensing fee to do medication therapy management so that they can help our clients think through exactly, you know, their prescription drug needs and make sure that it works well for them. And then last week, we just received news from CMS that we will be a recipient of a $2.8 million grant. It's called the Medicaid Transformation Grant. That will allow us to help facilitate the ability to communicate with providers as to how this best can work in terms of how our payment for performance arrangement would work, how this care coordination model would work. It would be ability for us through a web-based system to automate our prior authorization process and our medication therapy management process with pharmacies so that we can better communicate these between ourselves and providers. Eventually, what we need to do, of course, is see providers be able to communicate better amongst themselves as well. And we're working towards that, and you heard about that from the health department previously in terms of the e-health initiatives. So we're real pleased with getting this grant from the federal government, because the federal government is starting to realize that what we need to do to more effectively manage our health care services for our clients is go beyond paying claims. And we have to provide the ability to help people navigate through the health care system, to do chronic care management, or to do medication therapy management. The federal government is understanding that we need that kind of resource. And so we have a program called MITA, Medicaid Information Technology Architecture, that we're pursuing with the federal government to get the resources necessary to better manage our health care dollar.
Hey, Commissioner, the page you're talking about now is just fee-for-service, and why aren't you doing the same thing in your managed care?
Mr. Chairman,
our people that are in managed care.
Mr. Chairman, we rely on managed care organizations to, you know, their job is to figure out how best to provide either disease management or chronic care management to our clients. In fact, we direct them through our contract that they have to have a cardiovascular disease management program for our clients, a diabetes program. I think we added asthma. No, we have not added asthma. So diabetes and cardiovascular services. So we direct the managed care organizations to provide that kind of coordinated care. But it's up to them as to how they go about doing it, as to whether or not they develop a model like this. As I said, we hope to model something like this for them, and hopefully maybe they'll adopt it over time. But one thing that we're working with the Institute of Clinical Systems Improvement on is how best to support primary care in this state in terms of how to provide the right reimbursement for them to better manage healthcare services for their patients. So there's a lot of emphasis on this issue. And this does not necessarily get to the point and the concern that maybe St. Mary's Luke Clinic raised to you. That's a bigger issue yet, as to how do you align all the incentives of all the services that are provided out there to make sure we're doing the right thing. This addresses that in part, but this is probably not the entire answer to that dilemma that you heard about from them.
Commissioner Osberg, if you go back to page 123, there's a chart there comparing fee-for-service program cost increases with managed care cost increases. And I see that the managed care increases went up 10.2% and fee-for-service only went up 4.5%.
Mr. Chairman, the biggest reason there is because of a ratable reduction that took place to the hospitals during that period of time. That's probably the biggest contribution to why that's lower. You have, again, in the fee-for-service arrangement that we have, we pay less to providers other than in the pharmacy area. The pharmacy area is the one exception. Otherwise, we pay less, in most part, to providers than what the managed care organizations pay to providers for seeing our clients. And so that's what probably took place in the 2004-05 piece is the biggest contributor to that. Looking at the two graphs now, I can't tell whether or not, you know, the average ought to be the same or not, but we could make that calculation for you. But that's the biggest reason that comes to my mind, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, as we're looking at providing payment spec, I think this is a great idea, being able to apply some of that managed care incentive to a fee-for-service system is a goal people have been pursuing for a while. I'm glad to see it being applied. How do you measure and verify that these people are doing what they say they're doing so that when the payments go out, it's kind of the fraud, holding their feet to the fire kind of piece of this?
Commissioner.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald. We will, in fact, I'd like to ask Vicki Kuhner, our Director of Performance Measurement and Quality Improvement, to come down and talk to you about how best we're going to measure this. But we are going to rely, certainly, on not only claims information, but to medical record information. In fact, part of this proposal is to get resources to go out and extract medical charts to measure this.
Ms. Kuhner, welcome back to the committee. Some of you may not know that you actually worked for this committee at one time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Kuhner, and I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm the Director of Performance Measurement and Quality Improvement, and I'm responsible for this project. We will determine the actual results for our clients through managed care chart reviews collected in sent to Minnesota Community Measurement. And for fee-for-service, the design is that every medical provider that has access to our minutes, which is an automated sort of encrypted mailbox, will complete a little score sheet that gives the actual results, not just that they took the lab test, but the actual results for our clients. And when that gets sent to the system, that will trigger a payment to that provider who brought that client with diabetes into good control, or the cardiac client into good control. And then that'll give us the information that maybe Mary Johnson's diabetes is in good control, and so we can issue a payment to that individual clinic, any pay-to provider that is working and providing diabetic care to Mary Johnson.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm curious about is, as they're filling out this online form, how do we know that they're being honest about it? Are you going to do a sample, a random sampling of medical records to review and make sure that those applications are accurate, or how's that going to work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, one of my other responsibilities is we have a provider fraud and abuse unit called CSRS, and we will probably start to do periodic confirmations of going out and checking records, because we will then have a record of if there's any misuse or abuse, because they would have to, this is all, we're waiting for the 3 or 4 years before we have access to electronic health records, but this is sort of an interim step, so we would have a trail associated with an individual pay-to-provider, particularly for the fee-for-service. That wouldn't be the same for managed care clients.
Thank you. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to this medical home, I'm curious, what do you think the barriers are now as to why that's not happening? Why don't we see that coordination of services? And I guess I would like to see more resources put towards the interoperability and having that electronic medical record, because that seems to be the real bugaboo. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rood, I'd like to quickly ask Dr. Jeff Schiff to come down and speak to that. It's just 2 minutes. So I think that he has a very, he's been working on this issue of medical home for some time in his professional life, and I think that he can give you a very helpful insight to that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rose.
Just quickly, and I'm wondering why you think the $50 is going to be the deal breaker, why that will make the big difference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruda, I'm Jeff Schiff. I'm the medical director at the Department of Human Services. And to answer your question first about barriers, I think that as most of us know, the incentives for primary care docs are misaligned with the work they do, and as I tend to say, primary care docs get paid to make widgets, which is to see more patients over time, not for the outcomes of the care. This is our first attempt to move in that direction for our fee-for-service patients, to have them have the primary care providers have an opportunity to provide care over time. Specifically to the $50, that is not a perfect number by any means, and a severely disabled person who has many medical needs will require more care coordination, and someone who has a mild problem will require more, less, and over time we would like to get to the point where we can risk adjust that so that we can pay appropriately for providers to provide the care that's needed per patient.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one other comment. Looking at the outcomes, and if they're good outcomes, particularly I think with the diabetes, but I think it's important that we keep in mind the other barriers to the patient, that, you know, their bus line was cut, they can't get to the clinic, they can't take time off of work. I know there have been programs in other states, I think Arizona's one, that did an on-site program at the either county or state level, that the buildings had on-site services for their workers who had diabetes. So it was, you know, very convenient. They were much more compliant. It lowered their health care costs. So just a comment.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, the Chair, and to Commissioner Osberg or to the physician. If I understand this right, you said talked about a contract with a care management organization, and you were requesting 2.5 staff to coordinate the program, provide training to the clinics, and evaluate outcomes. And you know, some of the best outcomes research I've seen has shown that it's actually the regular clinic staff that work in that community who are doing it and have had some of the best outcomes. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about why we want to have a third party outside of the staff of that clinic, their nurses, their personnel who may have formed a relationship with that client through that medical home concept, why we're getting this third party entity with its own administration, et cetera, involved in doing the care management rather than working with existing clinic staff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I may have not been clear on that. This proposal does not provide for a contract with a third-party entity. The previous arrangement for an intensive care coordination model, we are contracting with an entity for very high complex cases. In this case, we contract directly with providers. So I want to make sure that's understood. That we're, this is different from the intensive care coordination model that we're currently putting into place.
Just a follow-up on that. Thank you for clarifying that because it wasn't clear to me. But I'm still not unclear about the need to train clinic staff. I understand the need to get additional dollars into the primary care system so that they can actually do what we hope and expect them to do in terms of patient education. I'm still unclear about the need for clinic training.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it's our feeling that providing a medical home in which the care is coordinated with the community, and for us to have expectations around care plans and around care management, is not a service that is routinely provided effectively in all clinic settings, and that to identify and to make sure that we clearly identify sites that are doing these components of the medical home will require training and site visits.
Representative Loeffler.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure whether the $50 a month in any way is going to cover the additional new documentation requirements. I see that, you know, the patient's going to have this care plan that they have to take to every specialist, and I'm just not, I support piloting, but I think we're once again adding a whole new layer of paperwork and administration for a tiny part of what may be a physician's particularly stressed load, and particularly in rural Minnesota where there's a real significant shortage of primary care practitioners. And if we really want to incent people to get involved and reward them for doing this kind of care, putting together new documentation systems makes me a little skeptical.
Dr. Shipp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, our goal is to have the documentation be as inobtrusive as possible, but it's our feeling in the medical home world that in order for patients who have complex illnesses to be served, a written care plan is a key piece of the documentation, and our goal is not to make a bureaucracy to enroll patients in that, but to make sure that patients have the time spent, which is reflected in a care plan, or those sort of efforts, so that they can receive that care, whether it be by another provider in that clinic or if they need to use an emergency facility.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is Commissioner Osgood or any of the other testifiers. Representative Loeffler touched on this a little bit. Whether it be in education or in healthcare, we're kind of balancing a couple different goals in terms of lowering costs and improving quality. And sometimes the improving accountability and providing performance incentives conflicts with our other goal, trying to reduce administrative costs and paperwork and other kinds of reporting. And as you've described this situation, I've heard a variety of kinds of reporting, some online for the fee-for-service, some actual medical charts being transferred for analysis in case of managed care. And just wondering, in terms of balancing these two goals of trying to lower costs via better management of disease, we're also looking at what it's costing both providers and the state to do the accountability for this system. And as you're going forward with these pilots or other similar programs, are you also tracking what it's costing providers in terms of additional administrative costs, and also on the state side, additional cost of state to implement such programs? Because obviously those administrative costs are another component of healthcare we're trying to get down. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, that's a very good point. That's why we're working so closely with the private community, make sure that we're in alignment as to what kind of requirements we have, either on the administrative side or on the clinical side, in terms of what we measure, and even to what extent how we go about doing payment for performance. It's real important to be lining that up, because otherwise providers are going to be subject to a myriad of different arrangements out there. And so we should not go on our own and do something differently. And that's why our work with Bridges to Excellence and the other employers is important. And the committee needs to think about return on investment. For this proposal, for example, there is a return on investment. The first biennium, yes, there is a net cost. But for time after that, the next biennium, there's a net savings and beyond. So I think you need to look at that. So our calculation is that there will be a savings to the system writ large by making this proposal happen. So that, you raise a very good point.
I have to comment there. You know, as good as healthcare is in Minnesota, the community measurement thing showed only 6% of the diabetics were getting optimum care. And unless somebody measures this, whether it be the clinic or the state, we'll remain at 6%. So somebody's got to measure that. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Assistant Commissioner Osberg and probably to Dr. Schick. First of all, the talk of writing care plans is making the palms of my hands sweat. It's been a long time since I've had to do that. And it's hard and important work. And I might be getting just a little confused between these two acute care proposals, but I want to just touch base on the paper performance notion. And when I think about my early nursing care in the care of people with chronic diabetes, I know that even if we were providing excellent care, and this is acute care in a hospital, that there are people with labile conditions that are very difficult to treat. And I just am wondering about the theory of paper performance
in the care of people with very chronic conditions, and if that creates some sort of disincentive for providers when they're reporting their labs and the labs show that they're not getting the optimal outcome that we would be seeking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, you raise a very good point. We don't want to structure something that discourages providers to see our clients, that maybe brings the score downhill, because you see our clients do not do as well as the general population in these scores for various reasons, and reasons that were pointed out in terms of, you know, complicating the situations for our clients. And so we got to be careful about that. So that's why we're having two ways of testing this, we're joining forces with the employers to develop a model whereby we're going to collectively incent providers to do the right thing. And then we're also going to pay directly to providers if they achieve optimal care for our clients. And we want to do is give incentives to them to do it. We don't want to, yes, this could be measured. This is going to be measured, and it's going to be publicly known. But we need to consciously balance those issues out. I agree with that. And any assistance you can provide us in helping us think through how best to do that would really be appreciated.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner, I will think about that and share my perspectives as well others. My issue is not with the measurement, but just making sure the incentives are in the right place and that we're not discouraging optimal care for those who are always going to be difficult to treat.
Commissioner, continue.
Yes, thank you. And page 136 is our next budget item, and that is to extend the critical access dental payment program that we have in place today and to make the add-on rates consistent in all of our programs. In the past, we've had a program whereby we pay additional amount of money to those dentists who see a disproportionate number of our clients. These providers have demonstrated a willingness to serve our clients and have actually provided capacity in underserved areas. And in the past, we paid up to about 40% above the fee-for-service dental rate in order to incent these providers to care for our clients. And we ran into a problem a couple years ago in terms of a limited appropriation for that. So last year what the legislature did is they put in place, for at least until the end of this fiscal year, until June, a add-on for medical assistance clients and a 50% add-on for Minnesota Care clients. 50%, again, above the fee-for-service rate that we pay dental services. What we're proposing here is one is to extend the program beyond June 30th. In other words, put this in place beyond this fiscal year. And to have the rate be the same for Minnesota Care and medical assistance, have it 33% above the fee-for-service rate for all of our clients, and not have a differential between medical assistance and Minnesota Care. We don't think that makes a lot of sense necessarily. We still think 33% above the fee-for-service rate would be sufficient incentive for dentists to see our clients. We actually have now, we're going to have over 200 dentists who will be in this category of providing critical access. That's almost twice the number we had a couple of years ago. So this program is working, and we appreciate the support the legislature has given it in the past. And we want to continue it beyond this fiscal year. So that's what this proposal would do. And it costs, as you can see on page 137, it costs $10 million for the biennium. And we're suggesting finance out of this out of the Health Care Access Fund. That's how it's financed this current fiscal year. And we're suggesting to continue to finance it out of the Health Care Access Fund going forward.
Commissioner, so this is, you're going to fund the MA increase out of the Health Care Access Fund as well as the Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's what we're proposing. We think dental access and mental health access, which you're about to hear about, is two biggest challenges for our clients. And so we think that it's very appropriate to finance this out of the Health Care Access Fund because it will improve access to oral health care, which is a critical service.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we already have a hard time getting dentists to take Minnesota Care. In fact, I don't know if they take any too close to where I live. So doesn't that complicate the Minnesota Care people?
Mr. Commissioner, Representative Trumba, again, we just put into place last month the 50% add-on for Minnesota Care. We think a 33% add-on would be sufficient in terms of providing that incentive. So we don't think we're bringing from 50 to 38 that will complicate matters. There's other things we have to do to improve access to dental care. This is only one factor. And you'll be able to get a report from us next month. It's a periodic report as to what we're doing in terms of improving dental access. There's workforce issues. There's many other issues. You know, we're looking at teledentistry or urgent care clinics for dental services. We're looking at developing a oral health solutions project whereby a public health approach needs to be taken in terms of providing better coverage to our clients, whereby Head Start clinics and school clinics are involved in this, not just dental offices. There's a lot of things we have to do to improve dental access. This is just one aspect of that, and our report back to you next month will lay out the other things we're looking at. I agree that this is not sufficient. It's necessary, but not sufficient in getting improved access for our clients.
Well, Representative Trumba.
Mr. Chair, we always do this, you know, one day a year dental volunteer. And then, you know, and I usually volunteer, and then we kind of brief afterwards with the dentist. And last year, when we were briefing, the head dentist said he hadn't seen this kind of work since he was out of dental school in the 70s. And the younger dentist had only seen it in textbooks. So this, I guess this is going to be a little bit farther, is really way beyond, I think, what we even imagine is out there.
Mr. Chairman, it is a huge challenge, especially with the meth out there. Oral health care is just as critical in my mind as any other health care, so we need to make sure it is a priority.
Well, Mr. Chair, it was small children that were having the problem, not meth users.
We're running out of time, members, and just for the record, I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Hosh moves the minutes. Any discussion of the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted, and members, we're going to have to recess this meeting until 6:30 this evening. And we will meet in this room 200. So, thank you. Meeting is in recess. Why don't we resume the meeting?
Yeah, let's get going. There are at least one
of them. A number of people had other engagements they had to go to. So. Where's Brian? Oh, there he is.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I direct you to page 138 in your budget book. Describes the General Assistance Medical Care Program, which serves approximately 37,000 adults and adult children between the ages of 21 and 64. Now, this program is state-funded only. The federal government has not, and I don't see them in the foreseeable future, provide for Medicaid coverage for adults without children. So it's been up to the states to do that. And Minnesota's been doing that for 30 years now, since 1976. And again, the counties determine eligibility for people in general assistance medical care. If you look at A12, back in your green section, where the graph lays out the eligibility for our programs, you see that the federal poverty guideline for general assistance medical care is 75%. And on A10, it lays out what 75% is on a monthly basis and a yearly basis. Now, we also have a program called General Assistance Hospital Only Program, whereby people between 75% and 175% of poverty are eligible for coverage if they go into the hospital for any reason. And it covers hospital incision costs only. Now, does that cover costs beyond that? Now, again, remember, people in this category are also eligible for Minnesota Care. And, in fact, a lot of people in Minnesota Care, adults without children, are eligible for general assistance medical care. And it's something we'll talk about when we discuss some of our programs later. But the assets for people in general assistance medical care, the asset to limit is $1,000 per household. And for the hospital-only program, it's a little different. It's $10,000 per person or $20,000 for two. Now, there used to be retroactive coverage in general assistance medical care. That ended in 2003. And what also changed in 2003 was that we no longer provided coverage to undocumented non-citizens. Undocumented non-citizens get coverage through two of our programs. One is through our SCHIP program, whereby undocumented pregnant women get coverage. And the other is through emergency medical assistance. But you have to have a Medicaid basis of eligibility to be eligible for emergency medical assistance. In other words, you have to be a child or a pregnant woman or a parent or an elderly person or adult. Adults without children are not eligible for emergency medical assistance. That discontinued in 2003. What also happened this past year was that something called transitional Minnesota care, whereby people are being shifted from general assistance medical care into Minnesota care. Those people who would otherwise be able to be served well under an insurance program like Minnesota care. A number of people are exempt from that. People that end-stage renal disease, for example, or people who are on the chemical dependency consolidation fund, chemical health consolidation fund, and others are exempt from that transfer. But beginning this past September, a number of people have been transferred, are being transferred from general assistance medical care to Minnesota care. And that'll continue for some time.
Commissioner, could you give us the approximate number of people that are going from GAMC to Minnesota Care?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't know offhand, Kathy. We will find that number out for you. But it's a minority, if I remember right. But it's still...
hundreds of thousands?
I believe it's around 15 to 17,000. So it's a big number, but it's still a minority of the population in general assistance medical care. We'll find that number out for you.
Representative Lockwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I hope you did notice the how low you have to go if you don't have children at home. If you're a pre-nester, an empty nester, a never nester, 75% of poverty for one person is $613 a month or $7,000 a year. And even at the generous 175% of poverty, basically if you earn, it's somewhere between $7 and $8 an hour, you're out of the program. And I hope that as you're going through this transition of trying to get people into Minnesota care and then they drop the premium payment by the county drops off, I hope you'll be tracking how many people drop coverage, because at that really low, low base income, it's pretty hard for me to imagine that we're going to be successful in collecting much in the way of premiums and having continuity there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lopez, that's a good point. In fact, we'll track that. We'll also track how many people cycle back into general assistance medical care, because you're able to do that under the current situation. So we'll track those numbers.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
One other question, and you may need to do some research on this, but I have heard of physicians refusing to do surgery, needed knee replacements, things like that, for people who are under the GMC hospital-only program because they can't get the appropriate post-hospitalization therapy and follow-up covered. And I'd like to know how much we're running into those kind of circumstances, because the hospital only protects the hospital as a provider, but it doesn't necessarily protect the person. Typically, you're discharged out of the hospital with a requirement to have ongoing follow-up care, and that isn't necessarily covered.
Mr. Chairman, good point, and we'll see whether or not we can follow that as well, because we only have a few hundred people in that program, and perhaps there's something we can do to see what happens to them after. Because, again, they are eligible for Minnesota care, and to the extent they enroll in Minnesota care, we could maybe determine that. So that's a good point.
Just to follow up,
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Osberg, I think you're actually going to have to look at the denials. I think it's still true that if you're on a public program and you're denied a service, they have to fill out some paperwork and let you know, and I think you'd have to look at that instance to find out of how many doctors are actually saying, I'm denying this service because of inadequate follow-up services being available.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just a more basic question for somebody who's more of a beginner at this. Could you just spell out for me the practical difference for somebody from moving from GAMC to Minnesota Care?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, yes. What happens is that they would pay the premium. The benefits are the same, I believe. The benefits are the same. No, they're not. Okay. Kathy, could you come down and speak to that? All right. But they do have to pay a premium. In fact, the counties pay the premium for the first 4 months. So, and then we'll find out exactly how the difference is.
I don't know if I can do much better, but Kathy Henry from the Department of Human Services. The GMC benefits are, there's more benefits in the GMC program than there are in Minnesota Care. But I'm not even sure, Brian, you might have to help me with the current Minnesota Care benefit for adults only. Did they remove the limited benefit?
No, there's still for adults only, there's no longer a $5,000 cap. There's still a $10,000 inpatient cap.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that would be a primary difference, is the hospital cap in Minnesota Care versus general assistance medical care. I'm not sure about the copays either being different. It's kind of like a... Between the two of us, we might be able to figure it out.
Representative Leland.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to our testifiers, I mean, I'm really surprised that you don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, when we're talking about this, we move people from here to there and what's going on. I mean, I think we all need to understand what we're doing to them when we do that, and I would hope that, you could give us that information. I mean, obviously there are only a few committee members here, but I mean, I think that's pretty important stuff. Certainly to these people, it's pretty important, and we need to know the information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we'll do that. A13 does lay out the difference in terms of our benefit structure of our various programs. And then there's a more elaborate description of general assistance medical care on page 138 in terms of services and copays. And we could walk you through that. We can't keep all of this in our heads, Mr. Chair. It is very, very complex, and you're right. We do have, in fact, that's one thing I've been asked to talk about is how we're going to go about administer all of this. And Health Match is the system that we've been developing to try to automate all of these eligibility criteria. We have 16,000 eligibility rules, discrete eligibility rules or decision points in our programs. I've just scratched the surface in terms of some of the eligibility provisions put into our programs. I haven't gotten into refugee medical assistance and transitional medical assistance and our breast and cervical cancer program and our employee medical assistance for employees with people with disabilities. We have done a great job in Minnesota of maximizing what may be available to us to the federal government. We found ways to get federal participation to serve people. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to have complex rules and a lot of criteria for eligibility. I'm saying it is very, very complex. And so we've had systems in the past that have not been structured to do this for healthcare. We've used systems, what we call legacy systems, to structure more for our welfare programs and for our claim system to to really support eligibility determination for our health care programs. There's 83 counties, one tribe, and our Minnesota Care Operations all are responsible for administering eligibility for these programs. And it's done, by and large, on a manual basis. And if you look at what's happened the last few years in terms of audits, the legislative auditor did an audit, the federal government's done an audit, we have an error rate that's unacceptable. We have, it's not customer friendly at all to apply for our programs. So what we've decided some time ago is to develop an automated system. That's what we call HealthMatch. And you'll hear about HealthMatch, and you probably already have heard about HealthMatch, to automate all those rules. Now, to be honest, what's happened is that there's been delays in doing that for various reasons. One is that we underestimated the magnitude and the scope of this effort, to be honest. No state has done this. No state has pulled this off. In fact, in Colorado, they spent $200 million and the system failed. We have a contract for $23 million and we paid out $7.9 million so far. Gives you an idea of how much is done. It's a performance-based contract. We're not going to pay, you know, the rest out until, you know, we get deliverables. It's been 3 to 4 years now we've been working on this, and now, the other reasons is that every time we try to nail down the rules change. Not just because the legislature changed the rules, which is appropriate, but also the federal government now is getting into the game. The citizenship documentation piece that I'm going to talk about later on was a major change that was thrown at us a year ago. We didn't expect that, the federal government to require that we go out and do that. And now we have to do that. It puts a lot of the burden on the counties and our Minnesota corporations to pull this off really in a manual basis. And we changed in 2003 a lot of things. 4 or 5 years ago, it was real easy to get on Minnesota Care. In fact, maybe too easy. We weren't checking things. And we had a short application, and it wasn't working well because we had to follow up with our applicants and get more information. It still took us a long time because a lot of information was not available to that application. Now we have a much longer application, and it's too long. But 37 of those 44 questions are federal requirements. And we capture everything we need now in the application. Not everything, not just the salient points that we captured before. It's become so complex in doing this that we need an automated eligibility system so that the counties can be relieved of this burden. Not that they're going to be out of the game. They're going to help people apply for programs still. But people can, when Health Match is up and going, they can go online and apply, you know, apply themselves. Counties will not have to spend so much time, you know, actually inputting information into two systems, MAXIS and MMIS, because it all depends on whether it's Minnesota Care or medical assistance. You can have a family who be eligible for both, or, you know, both programs. It is so complex. Now, why is this so important to the legislature, this issue? And it is. It's important for various reasons. One is that Health Match is going to do a much more effective job in terms of program integrity, customer service, and administration efficiency, and so that we can get savings there. Number two is that, obviously, when you implement, when the legislature implements changes, we need to have a system in place to do that. Now, we can't afford to have Health Match delay your ability to implement things that you want to enact in terms of changes to our programs. We understand that. In fact, you know, of course, the governor understands that, too. And we have our own proposal that you heard last week that we want to be able to put in effect in a timely basis. So what we're looking at is ability to put some of these changes on our current systems. That may, they'll push out further Health Match. So we don't, that's the dilemma we're faced with, and that we're going to have to think that through with you as to what do we want to accomplish here, get more timely implementation of our new programs, new changes, or get a system in place that gets us to where we need to be in terms of managing our programs. We want to do both of those things. We need to accomplish both of those things, and that's what we want to try to do. But we're going to present to you options, you know, as you as you get further down the road in terms of looking at these changes, what exactly can you do to make this work? And what can we do to help you make this work? That's what we're committed to doing. And that's the Health Match story in a nutshell. And we can get into all the technical reasons as to why, but I can just tell you it's because of scope and complexity of our programs and ever-changing policy.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not having been here on this committee while you've been dealing with some of those issues, I wonder to what degree there's been serious effort into simplifying the programs before we automate them. I know there's some cost to that, but if we're really committed to increasing more access to affordable health care, that's one route to do it. I mean, we used to have one GAMC program. Now we have all these different doors that have different benefits, that have different entry points, and it seems to me one way to deal with this complexity is not just to automate it, but it's to look at those 16,000 different connection points and test points and say, you know, maybe we can never get down to 5,000 even, though I'd love to see it, but, you know, start moving it back down. I suspect there's some price tags connected to that, but there's huge price tags, as you've demonstrated, with the cost of systems upkeep, maintenance, and recruiting and training county workers and state workers, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, exactly the kind of discussion we had a few years ago is trying to simplify these programs. Actually, there was a proposal to combine General Assistance Medical Care and Minnesota Care into one program. But for various reasons, and just like when we talked about this transition to Minnesota Care from GAMC, there's reasons why some people should not be in Minnesota Care. I mean, because they're not eligible for Medicare, or they're incarcerated, or they're in a chemical dependency consolidation fund. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why some people should not be in a Minnesota Care arrangement. But we look at the notion of bright lines and simplifying all this legislatively. We're trying to do that administratively now. I'm not sure to what extent it's doable to simplify all of our programs overnight. Maybe we should, during the interim, discuss that. What can we do to make that happen? And we would love to be a part of that discussion, frankly. But right now we don't see that happening anytime soon. A lot of the changes that we talked about, of course, in some ways complicated even further. And so there has been discussion about that, but that's not happened since the last 5 years since I've been involved.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley. Commissioner, are you saying that the 16,000 rules in Health Match would all be embedded in such a way that when a person who is figuring out whether or not he or she qualifies for this, all of that will automatically give you and that applicant information so that they know they qualify and they know for what they qualify?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, exactly. In fact, a lot of people, as I said, are now in Minnesota Care. They're actually eligible for medical assistance. Okay. And some of them don't know that. And our system sometimes does not know that entirely. Now, we know a lot of people. In fact, that's another issue is that, you know, we get into the funding question of health care access fund versus general fund or programs. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've already heard about that deal. And what would happen is that if we had Health Match in place, a lot of people automatically would be shifted over from Minnesota Care to medical assistance. And that might be in their interest because they would not have a premium, for example. But that would put more of the cost in the general fund and less of the cost in the health care access fund. That may, in some people's minds, may be a dilemma in itself. So, yes, this would allow us to automate that eligibility determination real quickly. And right now, it's inconsistent in terms of how we determine eligibility, frankly, because it's subject to human error.
The other advantage, Mr. Commissioner, is that if they should be on medical assistance and they get put on medical assistance, the federal government pays half
right.
Rate.
Okay.
So why don't you continue,
right.
Commissioner Osberg?
Let me just turn to page 143. These are some of the other healthcare grants that we receive. I just want to point out a couple of them. One is the Youth Special Kids Grant. This is a very very effective and a very creative program Dr. Ann Kelly at the University of Minnesota is involved in providing care coordination for kids with special needs. It's a nationally recognized effort. And we've expanded that program the last couple of years. And so it's something that we have supported in the past. The other two programs I want to touch on is one is the Oral Health Solutions Project. And this is a project to try to develop a new model to improve dental access. We talked about that dental access issue this afternoon. And this will allow for us to develop a public health approach to oral health care, whereby we contract with a care system, oral health care system, not a health plan, not an insurance plan, but a care system that would then be responsible for organizing all the oral health care needs of our clients, including using Head Start clinics and school clinics, and using more effectively dental hygienists and dental assistants. And where the dentist really is more of a specialist in that kind of a model. And but we pay more to the dentist because they would be treated more like a specialist. So the model provides for higher payment to dentists under that kind of arrangement. We think that we need to test different ways of providing oral health care, maybe providing health care in general, a more public health approach to it. And this is what this model does. And we're going to test it in the metropolitan area as well as the rural areas. We hope to get this up and running by the end of this calendar year. The other is an Inova Community Foundation grant that we're providing for greater incentives, add-on payments to dentists down in the Winona area that they've put together and through a special arrangement. Mr. Chairman, the other pages are our administrative pages, and I won't go through them. Pages starting on page 145 and onward, there's roughly $164 million administrative dollars that go into my administration. Now, we support operationally other administrations too, like we pay all the nursing home payments through our claim system. We support the other administrations, but it gives you an idea that we have, what, $9 billion a year, or biennium, for our programs, our costs. And we have administration about $164 million. About 800 employees are in my administration, in the healthcare administration. The last item I want to cover is on page 151, and this is the change page. The governor's proposing appropriation to assist people in our programs to pay for required citizenship and identification documents. It also would provide funding for an electronic data match system to verify birth records for applicants and enrollees born in Minnesota. Again, I mentioned this earlier on, and that is federal government a year ago passed a law that requires that we get documentation of citizenship for our not only for applicants but for our current clients. And previously, our applicants verified citizenship by attesting to their citizenship and signing the healthcare application under penalty of perjury. Now the new federal requirements are much more restrictive, and we need to prove that citizenship. And one way of doing that is a birth certificate. And the cost of birth certificate is $9 in Minnesota, and if we have to go elsewhere to get it, it may be even more expensive. And the federal... You know, the federal regulations require that counties and Minnesota corporations assist applicants and enrollees who need help with obtaining documentation, which is good. We obviously want to help these people get to prove their citizenship. And by and large, it's working well. The counties have really stepped up here. Now, oftentimes when we ask for the legislature for resources to administer these programs, the counties don't get that resource from the legislature. They have to get it from, you know, property taxes, and they get a 50% match like we do from the federal government to administer our programs, but still they have to provide that support themselves. So the counties really, you know, we have a state-supervised, county-administered system. Not all states have that. Mm-hmm. And the counties, by and large, do a very good job of managing this complex set of programs. We also have a special unit at DHS to assist counties and Minnesota care operations with difficult cases. And one thing, as I said, we want to do is, you know, we're in the process of developing a data match system with the Minnesota Department of Health that will verify birth records for applicants and enrollees. This would expedite the process greatly. We're asking for $736,000, mostly out of the general fund, on page 152 there. You can see the detail, and a little bit out of the health care access fund. Mr. Chairman, that's our last change budget proposal.
Commissioner, the same citizenship documentation it would be required for anybody applying for the family planning waiver medical assistance?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
And what's the cost of that, just the citizen verification?
We don't know. We at one point estimated it would be another additional 20 minutes, if I remember right, to process that part of it. So the cost is administrative cost of more time spent on the application itself. So it's hard to tell how much more that would translate it into in terms.
The applicant would have to have a birth certificate?
That is, or a passport, which a lot of applicants do not necessarily have, or there's other vehicles as well. But birth certificate is the most common way of demonstrating your citizenship.
And they can, currently it's a little easier to get a birth certificate than it was 10 years ago.
Mr. Chair, still a lot of people have, especially elderly people, have a hard time finding that birth certificate, and no doubt about it. And it's not easy necessarily to track down. And so we're going to help them produce the documents necessary to prove their citizenship. And that's what this page is all about.
Well, the last time I got my passport renewed, it was somehow St. Louis. I was born in St. Paul, but somehow St. Louis County was ended up giving me my birth certificate. How it got from St. Paul to St. Louis County, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, this data match system is going to help us track some of that.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Loeffler. In terms of the $9 charge for a person born in Minnesota, once you get this data link with the MDH birth records, will that still be expected that you're going to pay that $9 charge, even though this should be handled electronically and it might be a nice revenue source for MDH, but if you're all a part of state government, I don't think we should be charging back and forth.
Did we know that? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Kathy McDonough from the Department of Human Services, Representative Loeffler. Right now, we're in the process of developing this system, and so we don't know for sure what the cost would be for a query to do that match. It could be, we're hoping it would be less than $9, but like I said, we're still in the development stage, and so it's not for sure what that cost will be. But it will be an immediate match so that the person doesn't have to wait. Sometimes now they're waiting 2 or 3 weeks to get that birth certificate so they can get on the program.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Chair Guest, I would hope that it would be an automatic electronic that you put in the city of birth or the, you know, if they don't know that, at least Minnesota, and the birth date, the name, the Social Security number, and it would come out. I'm aware of, you know, background check and credit check services that can get you a response in seconds, and I don't think there should be a charge back and forth once you finally get that electronic link. And so I'm hoping we'll move towards that. Since people apply for a variety of programs, I mean, they may apply for food support, they may apply for medical assistance, they may apply for, are we going to go through this process at every single point or with, are we going to have integration of systems so once someone's established their citizen or when they renew their MA, will they have to reestablish it all over again with a piece of paper?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, medical assistance is the only program at this point where people have to document their citizenship.
However, once the documentation is obtained, it will be entered on in case notes or on Maxis or somehow whatever system they're on. We are also obtaining records if they happen to be in the food stamp file or the input file. We can obtain those records like a birth record or a driver's license for use. So we have been exchanging information between the various programs to help people who are applying. So yeah, the answer to your question is yes.
And just one
Representative Loffler.
Final question. Particularly for seniors who now this is a new requirement and may have be suffering from Alzheimer's, may not remember where they were born, don't know what, where, I mean, is there an exception to this federal policy such that we can continue to provide services to them if they've been on the program before at least?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Loffler, people on Medicare are exempt, so that's very helpful for the elderly. And people now who are getting SSI or other SSDI disability payments are exempt. So those are, it's this requirement mainly affects families and children, but there we have had, actually, I'll kind of praise our system a little bit. We've been very successful. We haven't had to terminate or deny anybody yet because we have this special unit at DHS where if people run into problems, we help them and been able to resolve their problem. But with the elderly, with this Medicare exemption, it's been really helpful. But you're right, there are people who aren't getting Medicare or who don't remember where they're born, and we've been able to help them.
Any Representative Lee Wing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was going to ask a different question, but actually your answer to the last question raises another question for me, which is, are you saying that you're, even though you're doing this verification now, you're not finding that we've got hordes of undocumented people trying to get on our programs? I take it that you're not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we haven't found that to be true.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, no, if I can, and then I was my real question I wanted to ask was about page 152, and that is you have this small amount of relatively small amount of money coming out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and I just wondered how you decide in that case, Commissioner, how you make the decision about how much money is going to be requested out of the Healthcare Access Fund as opposed to the general fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, what we normally do is it does apply to people in medical assistance, I mean, Minnesota care, because we have medical assistance funds. So we try to determine proportionally how many people affected. General assistance medical, I mean, in medical assistance, we have 440,000 people. In Minnesota care that are subject to this kind of requirement, we have many fewer people. So we try to do it proportionally, but I'm not sure if that's, I can ask our financial people as to how they came about that. Unless, you know, yeah.
No, that's correct. We did try to, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkling, to determine proportionally how many people would be on Minnesota care that would need help and how many people would be on medical assistance and decide in that way.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Commissioner, and
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for considering our proposal.
And next we'll hear from Wes Koistra, Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wes Koistra from the Department of Human Services, and I have one remaining change item that I've been anxious to cover with you. It's on page 228. It's fairly simple and it's fairly straightforward. This is a reduction in appropriation for services provided at the Minnesota Security Hospital. The Minnesota Security Hospital serves individuals who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. We have recently requested significant new funds for this last year because we were seeing an increase in the growth of this program. Historically, we were seeing a growth of only about five individuals a year. After the Rodriguez incident, that growth was later projected to be about 25 per year. So last year we requested additional appropriations to cover what was the growth trend at that time. And now we're seeing a growth, that growth trend has fallen to about 19 per year. And as I mentioned in the Senate committee, we're even, in the, as we're reviewing this again for the February forecast, we're seeing some even further declines in growth trends. This page may change a little bit after that. But what we try, while this is appropriated, and it's not appropriated as part of the forecast, we tried to forecast growth in this program in the same timing as a forecast, because this is one of those situations where people are committed to us. We need to provide the treatment. We need to provide the service. And so we think it's the best approach to this is to come forward to you when the growth is increasing beyond projections for new funds, and come back to you for decreases in appropriations when those growth trends turn the other direction. So these savings just represent a reduction in the growth trend from over what we had last year to last year's appropriation.
Representative Hodge. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. From my understanding, then, the projections was an increase of 25 per year, and now it's down to 19. So that six-person reduction, does that attribute to the $1.6 million reduction?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we have to do is take the growth trend in patients and apply it to units. Our units are generally 25-bed units, so if we have a reduction in growth that prevents us from opening a unit, we get a stable, essentially a whole unit's cost. So it's a formula that people have at the office that they put together, and based on that growth trend, they have to determine what the timing of each unit is. So this really does represent, as I believe, a whole unit's reduction at St. Peter.
Representative Hodge. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, that's a good answer. I just wanted to point out how much we can save when we do give appropriate mental health services, and how much it can cost us when it gets to such a severe and dangerous point. If we can save one unit, that's $1.6 million, and six people can affect that kind of savings.
Any further questions for Commissioner Cloyster? I don't see any commissioners, so
thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And so that's it. And thank the members that made us back here.
Very dedicated. And with that, I'll adjourn the meeting.
Okay.